Hey, welcome to the spoiler edition of the Game of Thrones podcast brought to you by baldmove.com. This is for episode 2, Home. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Good news, Jim. You get to keep your job, apparently.
What do you mean?
The overwhelming, almost unanimous response from people to our query about how to structure this thing was keep Jim on.
Almost unanimous. I want their names.
Okay, Ramsey. Calm down. And it's, I suspected this, but it was nice to see confirmation that the book readers privately enjoy, well, publicly enjoy now, when you say, like, wait, what the fuck, on, like,
right,
theories as they come forward, and the show watchers that are joining, kind of dipping their toe in water, this is all new information for them. So recapping, the book readers don't find the recaps tedious, and they enjoy hearing non-book readers' reactions to them, and the show watchers, it's actually helpful, so that's nice. The other thing I wanted to talk about, because I get a lot of this, a sizable percentage of my emails are people asking me if I've considered theory X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. I just want to remind everyone at the top of the podcast that there is an archive of the spoiler podcasts by subject and even time code included in a link to every show notes. And you should be able to get that through your pod player. If not, if you can definitely go to baldmove.com, look at the show article, and it's all right there. And again, it's got every topic. Like, if you want to know if I've talked about is Tyrion a secret Targaryen, there's is Tyrion a secret Targaryen. Click on it, and the time code you need to get to the part in the podcast. So that would save everyone a lot of time if everyone checks that out. So also something that organically happened on the forums is a corrections thread. For things that I get wrong, or people that maybe think that I didn't put the necessary emphasis or spin on something that's been started. And I think that's a really cool feature, which I support, because I'm not perfect. I'm not going to get everything right. This week's the big correction was, I said in last week's podcast that the character Victarion Greyjoy, who is another brother of Balin's, we met one on the bridge this week, had been cast. I mentioned he had been cast multiple times, and that is not true. It's only been Euron they've actually announced that was cast before the season. So that means that some of the theories that I might have discounted before about, you know, Yara, Theon's sister, or Theon being dispatched on the mission that Victarion goes on in the in the books, those theories are back on the table.
Okay.
Also, something I forgot to mention or didn't even remember, someone reminded me on the forum that in the books, Ghost is named not just because he's white, but also because he's silent. He doesn't make noise. And they thought it was, you know, a little bit evidence of warging going on that he was so vocal when he was pinned up, you know, while John was dead. Now, yeah, there's a lively back and forth about, well, in the show that he's actually growled. But I think that even if you want to say that, there's a quantitative difference between a dog growling or bristling or baring his fangs and actually howling.
Okay.
You know, making vocals. Right. So you could say that that is aberrant behavior for Ghost, perhaps, definitely in the books, maybe in the show, and like we discussed on the main podcast, I still think there is, I've seen this episode 4 times now, and I might be crazy, someone might have warged into me myself, but I feel like that there still is a little bit of evidence, enough that you can't completely dismiss it to say that there's something special between, you know, John and Ghost, and that might have been.
Yeah. I would say there's room for that theory.
Sure.
There's room for that to be true, but there is no real evidence to support it, because his master's dead. Like,
yes,
this connection he's got is dead.
It could have just been he probably heard his heart feel restart, that, or who knows.
Right, right. So there's still room for it, though.
And then the fact that there was such a long pause after Melisandre did her thing, like, it's really, who knows? Because
explain to me how the magic works exactly.
Yeah, right?
Right?
Yeah, well, you see, it unbinds ATP within John's mitochondria, and I don't know. I mean, that's the beauty of it, and I wonder if they're actually going to go back and talk about this a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if Melisandre is going to claim, you know, Lord of Light's back on, I'm infallible, I was right all along, I never doubted myself.
Right.
Whether she's going
to
be
it's
more...
It's a catch-22, right? Because you got to doubt in order to resurrect,
yeah,
and then once you resurrect, you no longer doubt. So, like,
yeah,
how did, what is it, Thoros
of Mir,
how did he do it so many times?
Yeah, it's true.
Like, he unlocked that power. Like, that's an achievement he got, and then boom, he can start doing it willy-nilly.
It seems like he was humbled by the experience.
Okay.
And I wonder, I'm hoping that happens to Melisandre, too, that she's humbled by the experience and realizes, God, like, so. Oh, man, I murdered this child, and really for no good reason.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So I want to move on to a couple other topics because, my God, there's so many. I've done hours and hours and hours of prep and research and combining emails, and I still feel like I'm ill-prepared to do this podcast. But the one that I want to talk about, the one I think is most interesting, is the theory that Tyrion is not actually a Lannister. He's a secret bastard Targaryen.
Okay.
And I'm not. I've actually, I did a whole podcast segment on this, which is linked in, wait for it, the spoiler archives that you can access in every show notes for spoiler show notes. But I'm going to summarize. I'm not going to go into the book information. I'm just going to summarize the book information. You know, like in the show, in the books, Dany and Ser Barristan have a lot of conversations about her family. And one thing that Barristan kind of hints at was that the Mad King had a bit of a wandering eye, specifically towards Joanna Lannister, who is Tywin's wife. And there are other hints and rumors, and that's the thing about the Game of Thrones books is, or the Song of Ice and Fire, is there's a lot of rumors mentioned, like, you know, about, you know, Ned's bastard son. Like, a lot of people have opinions on whether, you know, who the identity of the mother is. There's a lot of suggestions about, you know, Stannis and his wife, and maybe that he doesn't actually have a daughter. Maybe she's the bastard of the fool, the court fool and his wife. But some of that is like just stuff that people are saying because they don't like those characters. Some of it is just because people like to gossip. Mm-hmm. And there's some things that seem like they have the ring of truth. And there's a couple of rumors that Aerys, on the night that Tywin Lannister and Joanna Lannister got married, essentially claimed first knight's rights and bedded her.
Mm-hmm.
So the evidence, such as it is in the books, is that, you know, anytime the Lannisters described in the books, it's always about their blonde hair that's the color of gold, you know, because they're associated with gold.
Right.
Yet Tyrion's hair is described as being like a pale blonde, almost white in certain lights, which is silver white hair is a very much a Targaryen trademark.
It's very much not on screen either.
Well, I mean, Viserion and Dany both have that silver hair.
Well, I mean for Tyrion.
Ah, yes, yes.
He is very much not pale-haired.
Yes. Tyrion also in the books has mismatched eyes. He has a green one and a black one. In some of the books where there's been discussion of past Targaryens that have gone incognito and they've done things like shave their head, the Targaryens have famously like purple violet eyes. Mm-hmm. And some when they're under disguise, sometimes people describe them as being so dark they're black. So there's some speculation that he's actually got a very dark purple eye, which would be another kind of backdoor indicator that he's got some mixed Targaryen blood.
Also not on screen.
Also not on screen. We'll eventually get to stuff that's on screen.
Okay.
He also, Tyrion famously has a bookish nature, which he says, well, it's because I'm a dwarf and I got to outthink. Like, I can't outfight my way. But consistently, the description of Rhaegar, who is, you know, Dany's brother, who would also be Tyrion's brother, if this theory is true, is also very bookish and spends a lot of time studying things and is more intellectual. Tyrion also has a long-held fascination with the dragons, which they allude to directly in the screen. This thing, this story he tells is sort of from the books. And also he claims he had many dreams of dragons when he was a child. And there's also this prophecy, one of the central prophecies in the books, where Dany's going through the House of the Undying, which is the warlock's, you know, tower that's in Carth.
Mm-hmm.
They mention that it's mentioned that the dragon has three heads, and we know the House Targaryen logo actually is a three-headed dragon. And there's a lot of speculation that Jon's one of those heads and Dany is another one of those heads, and that there's a third, and there's also three dragons, which means there could be three, you know, by necessity there'd be three dragon riders, which also mirrors the original Targaryens that conquered Westeros. Aegon had two sister wives. They all three rode battle dragons. So people are like, okay, well, if Jon's one, Dany's the other, what's the third? Tyrion seems to make the most sense because there's a few things that unify all these characters together. Jon, Dany, and Tyrion's mothers all died during childbirth.
Okay.
In fact, that's assuming Jon Snow is the illegitimate child of, you know, Rhaegar and Lyanna. She died giving birth to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's confirmed that Joanna and Rhaella died giving birth to Tyrion and Daenerys, so that would tie all their characters together thematically.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all had to kill someone that they've loved. Jon killed Ygritte directly in the show, and he feels regret for what happens in the books. Tyrion was killed Shae. Daenerys had to kill Khal Drogo, you know, smother him with the pillow. The other interesting thing is that Tyrion custom designed a saddle that would enable Bran, the crippled Bran, to ride a horse, which kind of gets him temporarily back into at least Robb Stark's good graces.
Mm-hmm.
And people are thinking that kind of engineering would be super handy if you had to whip up some device to ride something as complicated as a dragon.
Did Tyrion make that?
He designed it.
He designed it.
Actually designed it. So it's kind of like a foreshadowing of how his third head of the dragon might be useful.
Right.
Now, there's other competing theories. There's always the Bran warging into a dragon as a third head of the dragon.
Sure, yeah.
But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about Tyrion and his affinity to dragons that they just now introduced to the show, which I feel puts a little bit more weight onto the him being a secret Targaryen theory.
Now that he's down in the catacombs dancing with dragons.
Yeah, it also explains why, you know, there's lots of reasons, to be fair, there's lots of reasons why you necessarily don't want to believe this theory, and I go into those in the full podcast that I alluded to, but it also would handily explain why Tywin seems to have so much disdain for Tyrion. Because the theory goes that Tywin actually knows about his being a bastard, but he's, you know, he's too proud to admit it, and it also is too humiliating. So instead, he just takes all that anger out on Tyrion
himself. And you know, in as much as maybe he knew something about Jaime and Cersei as well, you could say that's in his character, right?
Yeah.
Now, we don't know if he actually knew about that or not. I don't think.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have held that close to my heart for a while now with Tyrion riding dragons. I want him to climb atop a dragon, ride back to King's Landing, and fuck up everybody who has been a thorn in his side for a long time.
And I think that's a good point about Tywin, is that I do think that in the show, they did a lot to suggest that, you know, he kind of knew what was going on.
Maybe.
because he asked some fairly pointed questions and he got the, what he considered the correct answer. But I don't even know that it's more like, oh, well, I'm satisfied this is correct. I'm just satisfied that we all are understood that if these rumors were to be true, then our whole claim to the throne would be bad, or would be invalidated, and that would be bad for us because we're broke.
Right. And he might, you know, as much as he disdains Tyrion, he might also feel that way about having a bastard son.
Yeah, the fact that the Mad King, you know.
Or his wife having a bastard son, right?
Like, sure.
Sure.
And that's the other thing is, like, was, you know, with the Mad King being the Mad King, I don't necessarily know whether Joanna was a willing participant in this, or it's just like, well, the king's going to do it. And,
right.
So anyway, you know, rape in Game of Thrones is shocking, I know.
Maybe Jaime found out. Maybe that's why he killed him.
So the other thing I want to mention about this whole Ramsay and Roose plot is in the books, Roose actually has a legitimate son who was like everything you'd want if you're a lord. He rode horses, he was intelligent, he was good looking, he had a good reputation among the people, he had a gentle and as gentle as you can be as a Bolton kind of demeanor, and Ramsay murders him because he's jealous and he's a bastard and he doesn't want this guy to succeed him. And in the books, there's a lot of hints that Roose strongly suspects it, if not outright knows about it.
In the books, which is Ramsay a Bolton? Is he promoted? Is he...
Man, that's a good question. I think he is, yeah. Like
he must be, right? Because why else would he even consider himself an heir?
No, I know for a fact, yes. Because that was key to Roose's plan is that... So in the books, the way it happens is they've got this girl, Jean Poole, who is one of the Stark kind of ladies-in-waiting. She's like Sansa's, you know, personal lady or whatever you call that.
Sure, yeah.
And
handmaiden.
Handmaiden, there you go. And they pass her off as Arya.
Okay.
And then in a complete sham wedding, Ramsay marries this fake Arya.
So if he's got a son, why would he make Ramsay official?
Because Ramsay murdered him.
So bastard Ramsay.
Bastard Ramsay murdered
kills, oh, okay,
his
okay.
legitimate son.
That makes sense.
Now, what I thought was interesting is there is a guy on Reddit who mentioned that when Ramsay went in for the hug, that it looks like he's kind of like feeling on his
buttocks?
His dad's no, not his
back. His buttocks?
His back, not his buttocks. We can't afford another gorilla penis to divert, you know, we got to keep it on the up and up.
You made the motion like buttocks.
I was kind of sweet. Yeah. But he was kind of feeling, and he suggested this is because Roose famously was wearing chainmail under his garments the night of the Red Wedding.
Oh, and he's feeling to
so
see
Ramsay
if it's
was
there.
Kind of like, I wonder if my old man's got the shields up, and when he found out that, because it's like, you know, you go to stab your father and it's chainmail.
Oops.
That's, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Because you just took your one shot and you missed.
Yeah. So that's when you got to bite his throat out.
I watched that scene and I'm not comfortable declaring my allegiance to either theory. He is in fact feeling the chainmail, and that's intended, it's a cool thing to notice, but I don't think it's, you know, requires you. But the one thing I want to talk about, this whole Ramsay murdering his legitimate brother, was that I think if you're a book reader, it's a lot harder to swallow Roose letting Ramsay in that close, because it's something you'd suspect. But in the show, since that's not a thing that they've introduced, maybe it's easier to believe that he'd be taken off guard.
Yeah. I agree with that. Like, if he goes around killing his brothers, I don't know that Roose lets him get that close.
Yeah, it'd be like, maybe even slap him in irons just preemptively. Like, you know, what are you going to do? But I thought that was kind of interesting to get into that backstory. This guy on the bridge who confronts Balon Greyjoy and throws him off into the sea. His name is Euron.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of cool details in the story about him. Which are not reflected necessarily. Some of them are reflected in the show, some of them aren't. He's described as being handsome with black hair. He wears a patch over his left eye. He's actually nicknamed the Crow's Eye. And his lips are a pale blue color because he drinks the Shade of Evening, which is the same kind of psychedelic poison that the warlocks of Karth drink, because they had kind of a purplish lips.
Right.
And he's kind of like has a little bit of a mystic vibe to him.
Did we see any of that on the screen?
No, but the things that we did But that's something that they've consistently done. Like, all of the characters in the books are consistently described as more flamboyant. Like, in the books, Dario has, like, purple hair and a forked yellow beard and gold teeth and, like, a whole bunch of other crazy shit.
Right, but it doesn't really... That doesn't imply much about him and his abilities, but, like, drinking the Karth stuff, that seems like maybe that might have implications.
I mean, I guess it's something they could show him, like, start doing. But sure, it's just something I just wanted to throw in for some details, because I guess I was expecting a little bit more freaky-deaky of a guy.
Right.
When he shows up there and dropped his hood, my first thought was, wah, wah. You know, he's just a dude. He's just a dude.
Kind of reddish hair.
Kind of like the same thing I had Dario. I thought Dario was kind of underwhelming. Yeah. And then they recast him like super, oh my God, it's Dario Nyquilis. He's putting me to sleep.
Uh-huh.
But the thing that they did put in from the books is that his ship, his dread ship, is named Silence because he has torn out all the tongues of the men who serve him.
Right.
And it's described as having black sails and a dark red deck. Guess why the deck is dark red?
They painted it? I don't know.
Seriously, it's kind of like the brown pants theory that it's there to...
Brown pants theory?
You haven't heard that joke about the captain that's sailing, and every time he engages in battle, he asks his first mate to bring him his red coat. And he asks, finally, he's like, why do you do that? He goes, that's because I don't want the men to see me bleed, so they don't lose heart. And then one day he sails over the horizon. He sees like 100 ships.
Bring
and his
me
first
my brown
mate
pants.
Says, "Do you want your red coat, sir?" And he goes, "No, bring me my brown pants." No, it's painted dark red because apparently there's lots of flogging and blood sloshing about and whatever.
Sure.
He's a super scary, horrifying pirate guy.
Seems like it.
I'm wondering how much of that they bring back into the show going forward.
Yeah, he seems like he's going to be a Dread Pirate Roberts sort of character, right?
But maybe more of a
whose
political
reputation precedes him. Sure, yeah.
The big bomb drop at this Kingsmoot that's coming up in the books is the fact that Euron shows up and, you know, puts in a strong bid for being the king, and also has this fucking magic dragon horn.
Right.
That they and he has one of his men blow it. And I guess there's like you know carvings and whatnot on the horn that glow red, and it kills the man that blows it. It's like this just crazy sound that comes out of it, and it like burns up the man's lungs, like it chars him from the inside just to blow it. So it implies that it's doing something,
right? And we know that dragons were just released,
right?
So maybe it does call in some dragons.
And that's
I don't
what his claim is, that it's
they're
this,
pretty
it's
far
the
away,
Targaryen
though.
Secret for controlling dragons,
right?
So
they're super far away. They're about as far away as you could be unless the dragons were on the other side of Essos.
I mean, I don't think it's literally like Batman summoning bats. I think it's if it's going to be anything, it's something like a dog whistle. But then again, who the fuck knows? And also, who's going to be the man that blows it if it's a fatal thing?
Right.
Like, is that something a Targaryen could do?
Maybe.
Since they're fireproof? Or
maybe
not?
Clammy Hands or whatever his name is. Damp Hair?
Sure.
What's his name?
He's spent all of his life, Aaron Damphair, training to be moist, just so he can blow the horn.
Are his lungs moist enough to handle the fire?
It's just like an e-cig to him. It's just vapor. It's the healthy alternative to dragon horn blowing. I also want to talk about something I noticed in the second watch or third watch or whatever is when Bran and the three-eyed crow are all tangled up in the roots and they're communing with the trees, as there's a lot of conspicuous skeletons of like animals and whatnot that are intertwined in the roots, which I found interesting because one of the things Bran learns in his visions is that the old Northmen, the first men, did some really freaky-deaky blood sacrifices to these trees. Like that, they would offer blood, and they would actually take the they would dismember corpses and fling up their innards into the trees and do stuff that like you have this sense of the first men being like the northern men, and they're like honorable, and like, you know, that's like the whole Stark thing and Ned, and they would never do something like that. But Bran sees firsthand evidence that like you know the really ancient first men kind of got up to that kind of shit,
right?
And I wonder. And that's also spurred a lot of theories as well, because in the books there's a theory because Jojen, Mira's brother, doesn't die like he does in the show. He progressively gets sicker and sicker. There's a in part of Brand's kind of training montage, for lack of a better word, the child of the forest, the little kind of tree looking girl that's the attendant of the Three Eyed Crow, feeds him this weirwood paste, which claims to be like, if I'm recalling correctly, like the nuts from the weirwood that they've mashed together. It's like something that is going to really pry open his third eye and allow him to green see. And kind of complete his transformation into a green seer. Mm-hmm. But it's described as being this paste, but it's also streaked through with like red, you know, like kind of like a goobers and grapes. It's got peanut butter and grape jelly combined. Well, this is this paste with this sticky red fluid.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of there's a theory called Jojen paste that, you know, theorizes that part of what is in the secret sauce is, you know, Jojen's blood.
Mm-hmm.
That he's either died or they've killed him as a sacrifice to awaken Brand's abilities. So I wonder if these bones and stuff are kind of to suggest that we're going to get some of these darker roots, literally.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought as a book reader is when Tormund came back and he was looking very, I guess, presidential. He was looking very leaderly.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of half expecting, and it's still, I'm not taking it off the table, for him to turn into Mance.
Right. I forgot.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm constantly looking now that they've introduced this aspect of glamour, which, why would they? Why would they do that if that's not going to be significant later? I guess it's just to show the fact that she's at a low point, but still, why do you show that power if it's not to introduce the concept for a further use?
It would feel a little cheap to me, honestly. Like, that's a cheap trick.
Yeah, literally, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how I would feel about that, but it's possible.
The other thing I wanted to kind of monologue about before we got to the feedback is the fact that I know a lot of preseason speculation, even last week, people were talking about how Sansa could fulfill the kind of vengeful role that her dead mother, Lady Stoneheart, fills in the books.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems less and less likely. Like, her having that friendly conversation and kind of, it's not a happy conversation where she's learning things about her sister and that she's gone off and she's missing and she's last seen with this man. But I don't know. It's certainly not an angry conversation. She doesn't seem like she bears any ill will towards Brienne. In fact, she feels stupid for not taking up her own offer. She already knows about the Lannister sword. It's looking less and less likely like Sansa's going to be any kind of Stoneheart surrogate.
Which still leaves room for Kat, maybe?
Maybe. I know you're... That's something
I would love to see that. Yeah.
But I don't know. That's just how I'm feeling about it now.
So we've got something kind of special that we've had in the works for about a week now.
Mm-hmm.
For the people who are exclusive to the spoiler section. We wanted to do something cool for them. We noticed that, hey, this phrase we come up with, mildly interesting, is kind of dead now.
Yep.
You know, not officially, but it's
rest
down
in
there.
Peace. It might get resurrected.
Maybe.
From time to time, there might be some words, some red priests praying over it,
but for the most part, it's dead.
It's mostly dead.
Yeah. So we wanted to commemorate mildly interesting with a shirt and we're going to advertise it exclusively for now here in the spoiler section so that you guys can get first crack at it. And then maybe if some of these other things, like the theme of it is the Hound kind of digging the grave and filling in, because, you know, the gravedigger theory with the Hound is all over the spoiler section. He's kind of filling in the grave of the phrase mildly interesting. And we've got a little tombstone there with him kind of, you know, just finished his foot up on the shovel.
There's the dates of the podcast from the time we started using it to the time it died. There's a catchphrase.
It's a cute little shirt. I like it.
Spoiler Morghulis. It was designed by Eric Wahlquist, which, of personal arrogance fame. He's doing the direct podcast for us now, doing the Guillermo del Toro.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Sequence. Our buddy Levi, go through and do a deep dive on a direct, each particular director's bodies of work.
Yeah, so I think it's a pretty funny shirt, pretty cool.
Yeah,
shirt.
He's a cool graphic designer, and I think the shirt is awesome.
Yeah, that's up in our shop right now. So if you go to gravedigger.baldmove.com, you can get a direct link right to the shirt. And you know, we host our stuff through Spreadshirt because they do all our drop shipping and printing and stuff. So it'll take you over there, and you can just you know, go through their checkout process.
And again, as I'm assuming that, you know, based on casting news and what I understand of the plot, that we'll get to the Gravedigger plot sooner or later, in which case that it will no longer be a spoiler exclusive. But because, God forbid, we spoil anybody, we're doing this cloak and dagger. Gravedigger.baldmove.com, all one word, gravedigger.baldmove.com to get to the shirt.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
The other thing I want to mention is, as always, we're entirely supported by our listeners. Yeah, we have a few ads, but much more than two-thirds of our income comes from people supporting us using our Amazon.baldmove.com affiliate link and by going to club.baldmove.com, which is what I want to highlight. You know, the fastest way to get a podcast is to watch us record them live. Like, if you want the instant take, like, literally 5 or 10 minutes after episode's over, mm-hmm. We're airing that. You have to wait probably another 30 minutes to an hour, depending on the internet traffic and how hard it is to edit and all that stuff. You can get it right away. Plus, there's a whole bunch of other bonus features. We just posted a quip. Also going up today is going to be a spoiler review of the new Captain America Civil War.
Already up.
Yeah.
Already up.
By the time you're hearing this, it's already up.
Yep.
That's something we do kind of fun, too. We have a spoiler-free review that we give to everybody, but the in-depth spoiler take we reserve for our club members. There's a lot of bonus content like that. We try to make it worth your while, and it's not that hard to do because we're only asking $1 a month mm-hmm. if you sign up for the year, $2 a month if you go month to month. It's economical. It's a great way to support us as independent podcasters. And again, that's the only way we're able to give you 3 podcasts a week on this show. So if you like it, you like what we do, you want to show your appreciation, please go to club.baldmove.com and check out our membership. So I took these emails and I kind of divided them up by category. The first thing that everybody was abuzz to talk about was the previews for next week. Episode called The Oathbreaker.
I didn't even see these. Okay.
So there's a lot of scenes that imply that we're going to see, probably as a Weirwood-inspired flashback, Bran is going to get to see what the events of the Tower of Joy.
Okay,
because you see a young Ned square off, and you know there's a famous quote about, the Kingsguard kind of march up, the 3 Kingsguard march up to meet Ned and his company, and the Kingsguard says, which is straight from the books, "Now it begins," implying this epic battle, and Ned sadly says, "No, now it ends." And so that's Tower of Joy. That's, you know, and if it's not coming up next week, then damn them for showing it on the trailer. And people want to talk about it.
And it looks every week like we're getting closer to R+L=J.
Yep. It's exciting. Teresa V says, "This week the Three-Eyed Raven made a big deal about not spending too much time in the tree or, quote, under the sea. We know that we're getting a flashback to the Tower of Joy next week. So do you think they will use the time limit issue to hold off revealing Jon Snow's parentage?"
They could, certainly.
This week's episode is almost too rewarding to book readers. With Jon Snow's resurrection, Euron Greyjoy killing Baelon, etc., it seems almost too nice of the show to also give us an R plus L equals J in the next episode. Most of my friends who watch the show are non-book readers, and they seem to be overly confused already. I mean, at least they could have had Baelon use Euron's name so they could have some clue who this rando hooded guy in the bridge is.
Right.
What do you guys think? Will they confirm the long-held Jon Targaryen theory or hold off to give show watchers a chance to get caught up?
Wow, that's a good question. So I feel like they could do a scene where they show the events, and they even show, like, a baby coming out of it. But, you know, if they don't use names and they don't really give show-only watchers a good indication of what's going on there, it could still be postponed for that reveal, right? That baby is, in fact, Jon. Like, he might be able to see his father and see Lyanna or whatever.
Yeah.
Bran might, but is he going to recognize what's going on? And are we as viewers going to recognize it? I know the book readers definitely will.
Sure, sure. And that's kind of what I was thinking, too, that these visions are going to be like pieces of the puzzle that hit the table. And eventually, I don't know if it's going to be next week or if it'll be another week or two, the last piece is going to snap in and everyone's going to realize at once, oh my God.
It's Jon, right?
I mean, I could definitely see that, like, either, you know, he pulls him out of the vision right as, you know, the battle's about to be joined, or after the aftermath of the vision, and we get to it later on. But
yeah,
I mean, and I don't think that's like a I think that's a, that doesn't feel like a tease. That feels more like a effective story, piece of storytelling.
Right. Right. At the very least, I'd like to see what Jon is going to be like now that he's resurrected.
Right.
Before I find out his parentage. Right. Before I find this piece
that's
of information.
That's a good point, too.
Because, I mean, if Jon's not all there, that could have even more implications.
Well, not only that, but knowing that he is a secret Targaryen, and a legitimate son of the, you know, of the son of the king, mm-hmm. is going to color the audience's perception of him.
Right.
So you've got a fine balance of kind of letting people get their own feeling of the new Jon before you drop the fact that, oh, by the way, he could be the prince that's promised, Azor Ahai, et cetera, et cetera.
Is it all this other shit? It's a little too much at once, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, if they kind of drip feed this stuff, I would be happy.
Yeah. And again, the drip feed or like the slow reveal sounds like they're jerking us around, but I feel like that's only a book because,
yes,
again, exactly. The majority of like the R plus L equals J stuff came out in like book one. So
it's been a while.
And then things kept on adding, like Dany's visions. And the mm-hmm. stuff just kept on adding, and it was additive, whereas there's almost been none of this hints in the show. So the show watchers, unless they've been doing some side reading, got to kind of be slowly brought around because this doesn't feel cheap.
Yep.
So there you go. Also, the thing on the trailer next week is we see the sigil of House Umber, which is four chains united by an iron circle. Their banners riding towards Winterfell. And presumably, whoever's running House Umber right now, because in the book, the Great Jon has been held hostage by the Freys ever since the Red Wedding, says that he has a gift for Ramsay. There's a lot of theories about what this gift is going to be. Jessica L. says, "It seems obvious to me that the gift that Ramsay gets is most certainly Rickon Stark. Ramsay mentions in Home that the Umbers, which are the Bannermen of the Stark, have committed to them for this confrontation against Castle Black. In scenes for next week, we see someone who looks like a new northern lord we haven't seen yet present Ramsay with a quote-unquote gift. We know that we last saw Rickon. He was on his way to the Umbers for safety, and Ramsay needs a Stark. A good way to provoke Jon and Sansa is to show them that they have Rickon. It could even bring about a different version of the quote-unquote pink letter from the books. Unfortunately, it seems like Rickon's only part in the books is to die and to lead to this bastard bull between Ramsay and Jon." So that's one theory. And have I told you about the pink letter?
I don't think so.
So the big cliffhanger in the Dance with Dragons is Jon's up at North chilling, and he's, you know, getting the wildlings settled into the North and using them to garrison the wall and do all this other things. And in the middle of all this preparation, he gets a letter called the pink letter because it's sealed with a pink wax that purports to be from Ramsay Bolton, who is residing in Winterfell, and it's a big, long taunt where he says, "You, hey, bastard, I have your sister Arya, and I've murdered your false king, Stannis, and, you know, essentially Nana Nana Boo Boo, come and get me. Right. And it uncharacteristically enrages and motivates Jon to finally break his vows, and he recruits basically a coalition of the willing, all the wildlings and all the black brothers that feel that feel personally loyal to him, and he's going to march them south against Winterfell. Mm-hmm. And that is what brings about them the black brothers to stab him to death, because they see that as a complete dereliction of his duty. And it's right. It's not the instigating act, it's the kind of straw that breaks the camel's back if this guy's out of control.
Okay. I feel like maybe you did tell me that, but
okay.
Good recap.
Okay. Having Rickon would definitely be as strong a motivation to come ride to save the day as having Sansa or Arya or anybody.
I would think so.
However, it really kind of relies on the Umbers, who are some of the most, as I mentioned in the podcast, some of the most staunchly loyal Stark men.
Right.
To just be like, fuck it, I got this Stark kid, and I'm going to give him to the murderous Boltons. That seems hard to believe for me.
Yeah, why would that happen?
Olivia D. asked the question. She says, the biggest question for me, after she briefly outlines the same theory, is why do the Umbers give up Rickon? Maybe the Karstarks just rat the Umbers out, and they're given no choice but to turn Rickon over. Or maybe, just maybe, we're starting to see the beginnings of the Grand Northern Conspiracy, show edition. Could this be the Northern Houses posing as allies to the Boltons to help bring them down? In the trailer for this season, we are shown a scene of Davos speaking with someone about the real war to come. And if you look at the banner in the background, the sigil is a bear that stands for House Mormont. Another thing to note, that's the same house that Jorah came from, and Jeor, the old bear that used to be the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch.
Yep, his dad, right?
Yep. Another thing to note is Sansa is seen in the trailer standing in a hall very similar to the scene that Davos is seen in, rocking a direwolf cloak. Instead of sending Davos to find Rickon, which is what happens in the books, since we already know his whereabouts as a hostage, could Davos and Sansa's task be to rally as many northern houses to remove the Boltons permanently? I feel like there was a reason the Karstark witnessed Ramsay killing his father. Folks are going to wonder what happened to Lady Walda and her child after Roose's death. Could these deaths come back and bite Ramsay in the ass with the Northern Lords? Kinslaying and breaking guest right are big no-nos in the North. That's a good point. So Roose is poisoned. I suppose Ramsay could just say that Lady Walda died in childbirth, because that happened all the fucking time.
Right. And so did the baby.
Yeah. Right. And that would wrap that up without him having to say, oh yeah, I fed him to the dogs.
Right. But like, so who's delivering that baby? Like, how loyal are the people directly underneath Ramsay here? This guy he's intimidating into saying,
like, the maester. It's essentially poisoned. The maester, right. And the car. I think the Karstark seems to be complicit. That's,
yeah, sure. But yeah. Like the maester, the you know, the whatever they call it, the nurse who's delivering the baby, yeah. Like, how many people are going to keep their mouths shut here?
Well, we know there's some sympathy to Sansa because, you know, the old lady has said the North remembers, but then we also saw that she was flayed alive.
Sure.
But to me, that's just going to further stoke the Northerners' resolve to oppose these people.
It's not
going
to
cow. I don't think the people from the North are easily cowed like that.
Yeah.
It's like just makes you... And there's this Grand Northern Conspiracy she alludes to is like really the only glimmer of light for the Starks in the books, because there's this evidence that all the Northern Lords are just playing along with the Boltons and the Freys and flattering them and lying through their faces, but they have this kind of rallying cry about the North remembers.
Yeah.
And that they are going... There's a big theory that there's going to be like the Red Wedding revisited, because in the book Ramsay hasn't, or there's a big wedding feast like the Lord Manderly is one of the houses that he mentions is on a side in the show. He attends, and he brings his big like mince pie with him as a wedding gift.
Oh boy.
And it's,
how dry is it?
Well it's strongly hinted that there's actually a bunch of he's killed and butchered Freys, and he's serving the Freys and Boltons this human pie.
Right.
Which also goes back to like this Rat King legend that goes to there's like a whole bunch of stuff that's tied into that. But bottom line is shit breaks bad at Winterfell, and there's also another like a Frey wedding that's scheduled, and there's a lot of speculation there's going to be a Red Wedding too, where the Northern Lords just put this, you know, down once and for all.
Yeah.
Which will be awesome.
Yep.
I mean, it's about goddamn time a wedding goes our way. I guess the purple wedding, Joffrey choking to death, kind of went our way.
Oh, for sure.
But then that led to Sansa being sold off to slavery to Bolt. So it's like, yeah, I want one that's like not even a split decision. Just complete, total crushing victory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she continues, Olivia does. Hopefully we'll start hearing a phrase being murdered in the Riverlands by the Brotherhood Without Banners. While Lady Stoneheart is unlikely, I'm still rooting for her appearance. I really, really want to see her. How great would it be to get her mother's mercy on Mother's Day? So wasn't that a thing that the Joffrey died on Mother's Day? The episode actually
did. I don't know,
there was something, or maybe it was the Red Wedding happening. There's like some kind of show history where the Mother's Day tends to be something ironic, and I don't know if that's intentional or if that's just happenstance, but it'd be cool. She also says supposedly Beric Dondarrion is reappearing in this season, which I have not heard, but I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the casting on the off season. Says, why can't we have Bran show us Thoros praying over her after the Red Wedding, or Beric giving her the kiss of life? I know I'm reaching, but I gotta keep the hope for Lady Stoneheart alive. If they can get the North back, it will free them up for the real war, which is winter. I doubt anyone in the South will come to their aid when the Whites and Walkers show up, and Winterfell makes a great stronghold for the war to come. I know we talked about this as we went. Any overall thoughts?
Not really, except I'm rooting for the same thing.
Okay.
I want Lady Stoneheart.
Okay, so far we've got the gift being Rickon without much dissent. Isagar, and there's lots and lots and lots of people that caught that. Isagar said, about the preview for next week, could the gift Ramsay is receiving from the Northern be fake Arya, a.k.a. Jean Poole? I know it would mean introducing an unfamiliar character, but it means Ramsay might send a pink letter similar to the one in the book. Also, a fake Arya in Westeros lays the groundwork for real Arya to truly become no one. It would also make Ramsay more formidable. The Northern lords who support him, and I imagine their numbers are dwindling, probably see the strategic necessity of him marrying another Stark. I don't know if that would feel satisfying, this whole introducing of a fake Arya plot.
Unless they're doing it in the same episode where they reveal Mance, like... Maybe that might be interesting thematically. I don't.
You've got all these like fakes running around,
right? One who actually looks like it, one who kind of does. I don't know.
I do like the fact that her being fake Arya and perhaps even dying in Westeros would coincide with Arya, the real Arya, becoming this faceless man.
Mm-hmm.
That kind
like
of
her name being used elsewhere.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool.
Is it possible that anyone can find Needle and bring it over as some kind of evidence that she's Arya?
I mean,
I doubt it, but like they haven't shown us anything that would suggest that.
My big question is, do the Faceless Men know about Needle?
I think they do.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
Arya, it felt like she did that without anyone seeing her, but how could you say? It could be anybody passing along. Or,
yeah.
But that's the other thing I want to mention that is kind of the synthesis for some other emails is the fact that what if it's Theon that the Umbers are presenting as a gift and he gets reintroduced into Winterfell somehow
next episode? I mean, they'd have to catch him pretty fast.
It's almost like they'd have to already be working together. But the reason this is a potentially cool theory is in the books, everything's told from Theon/Reek's point of view, and he's a legit crazy person from the torture. But there's this plot called The Ghost of Winterfell, where there's this unseen assassin that's going around murdering key people in Winterfell.
Okay.
And you slowly come to realize that Theon is having these psychotic breaks where he cannot account for large lapses of time.
Right.
And, like, you know, you'll see that he's having breakfast and the scene won't end, but suddenly they're having lunch. And these kind of coincide with the killings, and you start getting the idea that Theon, during these psychotic breaks, is acting out and killing these Bolton people.
Yeah, he is the ghost.
It would be cool to have him, you know, when he says, you know, we widely speculated, when he says, I'm going home, he's going to Winterfell, it'd be cool to see if either he gets in through being presented as a gift, or sneaks in somehow because he's got inside knowledge of the castle, which he does. And the way the Boltons operate, which he also does, and assumes the role of the Ghost of Winterfell as a vengeful thing. I think that would be kind of cool to introduce that into the plot.
Okay.
Are you ready to talk about Hodor theories?
Sure.
We have from the plausible to the sublime to the absurd this week.
Awesome.
Bailey L. said, when Lyanna was kidnapped or ran away to the Tower of Joy, I speculate that Hodor was one of the men that went with Ned to save her. He's friends with her, and the 30 seconds of screen time they had together showed that he obviously cares for her. So what if it's ominous or ironic that he does, in fact, pick up a sword? I had to cut out a lot of this email, but she cited as evidence the fact that when old Nan came to retrieve him, she said, you're a stable boy, and you'll never need to fight or use a sword.
Right.
And she says, you know, there's almost no wasted time or space or lines in Game of Thrones, so it'd be interesting if that came back around as an ironic twist that he does, in fact, have to use a sword to save Lyanna. And in the battle, it gets injured in the head where his scar is, and that is what has impaired his speech. Similar to what happened to the real-life story of Tan that I told in the episode. This possibly means that he's known about John and his true parents all this time, but has never been able to say about it, anything about it physically. I know we discussed this off-air. What's your initial opinion of this theory that Hodor actually accompanies Ned to the Tower of Joy and does battle?
I just don't see why Ned would let that happen.
Why would Ned bring Hodor, period?
Right. I mean, if it's more Hodor's own volition, like, I'm going, consequences be damned, maybe I could see it, but how does he keep up with them?
But then
how
Ned, as the acting Lord of Winterfell, says, fuck you, stable boy, I'm taking my men at arms and my actual soldiers.
And we're riding there. And
this war campaign, yeah.
Good luck keeping up. And that's the thing, like,
And that's the other thing is this. It's not like Ned rode right there to rescue his sister. This is like the very end of the campaign of Robert's rebellion. So he's gone through lots and lots of war and battles at this point. So Hodor would have to be just kind of tagging along that whole time.
Now the book actually says there were only two people who survived it: Ned and his brother.
Reed. No, that's not his brother. It's just one of his childhood friends. And
right,
Bannerman.
Right. So there's no mention of Hodor there.
No.
And I would think maybe if he were one of the only surviving people, he might at least get a mention. I know he's not a knight or anything. He's not a lord.
Yeah.
But come on.
The books aren't the show, but you know.
Right,
and the
books aren't the show. So
you can definitely use the two to kind of make the, that's what we're that's what the
that's
whole,
all I, that's all I can do. That's all yeah, I have to go off.
That's what
of,
this
so,
whole podcast is about at this
right,
point.
Right.
Trying to use them as shitty mirrors to reflect each other and figure out what's going on.
So I wouldn't say that it's impossible due to that. I would say it's less likely to happen that
it
way.
It would
though.
Be surprising, and they would have to do a bit of tap dancing and, sure. and some really excellent writing to explain why he would be along. You know, why would you have
yeah,
the stable boy tag along?
I would say, and I'm sure we've got a lot of comments about this, but I would say that line about him not being a warrior and not needing to use a sword could be setting it up for later when Bran has to work into him and kill a bunch of people, or
that's the thing.
Something
we've
like
already
that.
Seen him
we have seen
do
that,
and there's talk of that in this episode. It's like, imagine if Hodor ever fought, he'd be unstoppable,
right?
You know,
and he kind of was.
That's
when
what I'm saying.
Bran
it's already kind of
him.
Ironic because it's a super effective tactic,
right? And then it could definitely happen again. So,
Alex K mentioned this. This article that two Redditors worked together that has a theory that I think is ridiculous, but I'm going to talk about it because, you know, it's not like I don't traffic in ridiculous theories. That's the one thing we forgot to talk about, the bolt-on theory, which I'm not going to go into detail, but it's this theory that I talked, I think it's the second spoiler cast that I did. Again, consult the archives. But it's a bolt-on, Roose is loose theory that asserts that Roose Bolton is an immortal, skin-changing vampire. Which sounds ridiculous, but there's a surprising amount of indirect textual evidence for it.
But let's
and
not...
there's also thematic support in that you've already got the Starks as werewolves, you got the Frankenstein, Robert the Strong, Mountain, why not have a vampire? And something else, George Martin made another post on his little blog thing where he mentioned, like, it seems like he has an annual call for the book readers to calm their shit.
Sure.
And he's like, you know, the books are the books, the show's the show, there's some people that are alive in the show, they're dead in the books, there's some people that are alive in the books that are dead in the show, and there's some people that are maybe on the show human, and he said in the books they might be vampires, which is kind of like... What the fuck, man?
Right.
Is he being playful about this? Is he he's kind of winking at us all, or is he just, you know, giving subtle credence to the Dread Lord Roose Bolton theory? I don't know.
Right. I don't know. Do you think that theory dies with Roose Bolton stabbing in the heart here?
Yeah.
I mean, he does, you know, sort of stake him in the heart. Or does he get him lower?
I mean, you put it in high, it seemed like high belly to me, but you can definitely stab a man's heart from there.
Sure, coming under the rib cage or
yep.
something.
Yep.
The Starks aren't literally werewolves. They can temporarily control a dog, a wolf.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that Roose Bolton is going to literally be a vampire, sucking blood, immortal, that sort of thing.
Turning
into a bat.
I always enjoyed it as, like, there's no way that literally that's going to be true.
Right.
Although, I can't say there's no way. I wouldn't be surprised if there's no way that literally could be true. But it's also, I thought it'd be one of those great unfalsifiable theories. Like, okay. If you want to believe that Roose is a vampire, it adds a little bit of creepiness to some of his chapters. But if you want, you know, it's not super important to the plot.
Okay.
But if you want to know more about that, again, go to the archives and check it out. Because it's a fun and entertaining theory that everyone says, oh, that's bullshit, until you listen to it. It's like, okay. It's still bullshit,
right.
But it's surprisingly well-supported and entertaining bullshit.
And thematically, maybe it's there.
Indeed. So. Indeed. The other thing I want to talk about real quick about Hodor is that, and this isn't important, I just want to mention it just for completeness, is in the book, his name is Walder, not Willis.
Hmm.
And it seems pretty obvious that they just changed that to eliminate confusion with the Walder Frey.
Okay.
And they've done that consistently. Like, if they're, like, in the books, Theon's sister's Asha, A-S-H-A, but they changed it to Yara to avoid confusion with Asha, O-S-H-A, the wildling girl.
Oh, Jesus.
Girl. I know.
Yeah, that would have never flown.
Well, it's just like in Lord of the Rings, you got Saruman and Sauron.
Right.
You know, one's the white wizard, one's the all-seeing eye. Like, there's a lot of subtle transformations to keep people from being confused. They changed some Lannister names, cousins' names, to avoid confusion. It's just like, you got all these family names running around. You don't want show... If you know, I think the way show watchers work is if they hear this guy named Walder, they're thinking, oh my god, he's a secret Frey or something like that. And their show is like, nope, don't call him your tits. Don't want that to happen. But yeah, he's Willis in the show. This theory goes, and I'm quoting Tazo Green Tea here from Reddit. I'm thinking that Willis went far beyond the limits of... He asserts Hodor is a secret warg, like Bran.
Okay.
Says, I'm thinking that Willis went far beyond the limits of warging, which may have mentally damaged him and turned him into Hodor. I remember Jojen Reed warning Bran not to warg for too long or else he'll be trapped and forget he's human. The theory goes even deeper. Since Hodor was a stable boy, it's likely that he have chosen a warg into his favorite animal, a horse. We also saw in the episode Lyanna is very kind to Hodor and is also an accomplished writer. It's possible that Hodor could have warged into Lyanna's horse in order to spend more time with her. And as the Redditors theorize, might have been in control of the horse when it was later slain, potentially causing him brain damage.
Okay.
Or he could have simply spent too much time warging and ended up taking on horse-like characteristics, which in part could explain
why Hodor
is so comfortable carrying Bran on his back.
And has a giant horse cock. No, come on. Come on, this is an insane theory.
It's not giant's blood at all.
come on. Are we really entertaining this?
No. It could also explain why Bran is able to warg into him. If he actually has the mind of an animal, it should be pretty much the same for warg as or Bran is warging into other animals. Oh, my God. And they speculate that we'll later find out that Hodor is the name of Lyanna's horse. No fucking way, man. No fucking way.
Come on, he's got a scar on his head. It's clearly, like, physical damage. It's not getting stuck in a horse. Dead horse.
Yeah. No, I can't imagine that is a legit theory. But
it's funny,
like, strap in, because one thing I constantly run across in doing this podcast is people's inability to separate, essentially, fan fiction from a theory.
Okay.
Like, a theory has supporting evidence and predictive value.
Yeah.
Fan fiction is making shit up based on what came before.
Right.
And you got to know the difference if you want to, like, this to me is very fan fiction-y.
It is.
Take a bunch of facts, shuffle them together. You know, hey, kind of, sort of, from this perspective fits the narrative, but then, like, okay, so then what happens? There's blank.
Right.
Hodor's a horse.
Then you have a lot of, but what about this?
Sure.
Questions with sure. fan fiction.
But that's the bleeding edge tinfoil. Maybe too bleeding edge. Maybe cut yourself on it. Connor OB said, Aaron mentioned last week there may be something connected to Winterfell's crypts that was never passed down to Ned, and his flip of the script with putting Lyanna down there started the events with the others through some kind of, poorly understood mechanic. There's a pretty solid theory out there that Hodor has some kind of connection to the Great Other or godly nemesis of R'hllor.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Yep, here we go.
What the hell is the Other?
So the Great Other is essentially the god of death, the Stranger.
Okay.
Who is the god of darkness as opposed to the god of light.
Hmm.
You could say the god of ice versus the god of fire. Early on, Mel tells Stannis about the Great Other and describes it as the embodiment of darkness and cold. Also that the true name of the Great Other must never be spoken. It's very Harry Potterish. Coincidentally, in Norse mythology, the god of winter is named Hodur, which is H-O-D-R. I'm unsure of how to spell that, but I'm going to guess it's Hodur. So there is some unknown established connection or event that happened to Hodor that limited his speech, and no one knows what the hell Hodor means because the name wasn't meant to be spoken or is likely lost over time. He's just thought as simple-minded. We know that Hodor is one, if not the oldest person alive who's grown up and lived in Winterfell. He would likely have been around when Ned placed Lyanna's body in the crypts, and back in A Clash of Kings, he is kind of freaking out when Bran, Rickon, and company have to go down to the crypts to hide there while Theon is sacking the place. This is true. It's also mentioned that nobody goes down super deep into the crypts, so it's left as a mystery, if anything, like ice dragons, which is another theory that I might need to touch on, live down there. I think it's curious that young Walder or Hodor went exploring one day, or I'm sorry, he's theorizing now. I think that a curious young Walder or slash Hodor went exploring down there one day, maybe after Lyanna's burial, and went deep into the crypts and found the manifestation of the ancient actual other. Hodor was then left only able to say Hodor. How does that float your boat? The fact that Hodor coincidentally rhymes or matches closely with this old Norse god who reasonably you could speculate George Martin might have drawn inspiration for in some of his mythology and lore.
It's interesting because we don't have any indication of why he can only say Hodor, right? Yeah. I mean, if that's not his name, which I assumed it was before.
So I want to also drop something that I did in some researching in this theory. There's this at thecitadel.org, which is this archive, a repository of a lot of old and current A Song of Ice and Fire information. There's a part of it called the So Spake Martin Archives, which is essentially a digital copy of a bunch of correspondence that that Martin had with, like, he had this guy that was drawing pictures, like official A Song of Ice and Fire artwork. So it's like descriptions of characters and backstories and sigils and stuff to give this guy better information on how to draw them better.
Mm-hmm.
It's got speeches he gave at conventions. It's got, public letters that he had sent back and forth to fans and to other professional critics and other writers and authors and whatnot. But someone wrote in and asked for clarification about when Hodor went down and he was freaking out and afraid. And Martin gave this very cryptic response that Hodor was not afraid of the crypts before or after this scene. This was a particular time that he was afraid to go down. And he emphasized that it was this particular time, which a plain reading would suggest that he was just afraid because Winterfell was being sacked. And, you know, this is just a stressful, scary time for him.
Yeah.
Or it could have been that he was worried that there was something for some reason down there that would be afraid. But it doesn't seem like he was just afraid of the script of the crypts as just a scary place in general, or mm-hmm. a dark place, which you'd think like a simple guy might do. I don't know.
Right. Huh. That's interesting.
Before we give it too much thought, I want to get on a trip in who kind of takes off where this last emailer began or left off. He takes off from where they left off. What if Ned hid some evidence of John's lineage in Lyanna's grave below Winterfell, and part of the reason John needs to go back there to Winterfell is to find something that will definitively prove who he is? Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Like, even if John figures out that he is a secret Targaryen, how does he authenticate that?
Yeah, we assumed What's-His-Face would come back, the only other guy at the Tower of Joy.
Yeah. Howland Reed. Why do you believe Howland Reed?
Right.
You know? You're just saying that because you're a Stark loyalist.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps there's some Targaryen heirloom, such as the lost Valyrian steel sword or something to do with dragons. Some people mention there's a popular theory that Lyanna was buried with Rhaegar's harp, famous and recognizable harp. This kind of makes sense because, if I remember correctly, Lyanna is the first woman or non-king Lord of the North to be buried in a crypt, which is correct. What if to protect the evidence of John's birth, Ned hid in a crypt, which no one would think of anything because he loved his sister and would want to honor her? This also has some humor to it, as King Robert was paying his respects to his sworn enemy's son's birthright. The other thing is, as mentioned in the previous email, there's this mythology and legend that there's a dragon that lives below Winterfell. And some of that's kind of like a just so explanation for why Winterfell has these this geothermal power. The Winterfell's built over these like hot springs, so even in the darkest, deepest winter, it still is relatively warm there.
Mm-hmm.
And some people's like, oh, there's a dragon down there. But metaphorically, if like there's evidence of a Targaryen parenthood for Jon buried in those crypts, that would be kind of a fulfillment of a dragon, you know, being hidden within the crypts of Winterfell.
Okay.
Get it?
Gotcha. Yeah.
Like a piece of Targaryen lore.
Sure.
Would be a lyrical way of explaining that. I actually talk about that in the archive. So again, go down and look at that about the, I think there's something about Lyanna or Lyanna and the crypts of Winterfell.
Yeah.
The dragons of Winterfell.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, how do you prove your lineage? Like, that seems nearly impossible to me without it being general knowledge. Because, like, you know, say she's buried with a harp. He pulls the harp out. It's like, oh, I'm a Targaryen, and he knows it. But how, like, hand that harp to Tyrion. That doesn't make him a Targaryen. Hand it to his dad, that doesn't make him a Targaryen.
I think there's a couple things here. Number one, when do we as the viewers slash readers know for a fact that Jon is a Targaryen?
I think the flashback.
So second is, when does Jon find out and really believe in his bones that he is a Targaryen?
Right.
And then the third step would be, now how do you prove it to the world?
Right.
As we discussed in recent podcasts, that's not as super relevant as you would think. Because the right to rule only means something when the laws are functional and you don't have out-and-out war and rebellion. When there's a war rebellion on, it's like, well, fuck your strongest claim to the throne. It's who's got the might, who's going to win, and then you try to figure out who's got the best claim to the throne. That's how Robert, even though he's a shitty king, he ended up sitting on a throne because the Baratheons had a long blood lineage back to where they split off from the Targaryens a few years after they came across. So the Baratheons had the stronger claim to the throne than like any of the Aerons or the Starks did.
Okay.
So they made Robert the king, even though he is a complete asshole, terrible king. That might be putting it too strong, but I don't think anyone would argue that Robert was a great, effective leader of
Doesn't
Westeros.
Doesn't seem like it. Yeah.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Okay, so that's kind of like the topical things. There's a few other random emails that we have to consider. First from Doug L. I'm trying to make sense of why the Dorne plot panned out the way it did, and I think I wonder if this is a remix designed to make way for the introduction of a John Connington and young Aegon Targaryen plot. Which I might have to digress to explain a little bit here.
Yeah.
Books 4 and 5, especially Dance with Dragons, are about several characters racing to get to Dany. Specifically, you have Tyrion Lannister, Victarion Greyjoy, and Quentin Martell, Doran's son, all vying to get there first, with Hisdar Zolorak and Dario Naharis already vying for attention to Meereen. I think you know all those people, right? Tyrion Victarion is the brother of Euron that we talked about sailing with a ship and this horn.
Right.
With all these ships and horns over to offer a marriage alliance. Quentin is the son of Doran who gets burned alive by the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
The tension of the story would be who would get there first and what would happen to the others. The show has now remixed that to hell with Dany already ridden off, Quentin missing entirely, and Victarion not even having been introduced yet. So what to do? In the books, what made Doran interesting is the fact that he was playing two very long cons. And I might have a disagreement with you here, Doug. One is he's trying to get Quentin to Dany, but the other was that Rhaegar Targaryen's baby boy, the one the Mountain allegedly killed, was actually swapped for a different baby and raised in secret.
Oof.
So this is a theory, and I always understood that this was a plot by Varys and Illyrio to spirit away this, to basically swap the baby, take this trueborn Aegon Targaryen, raise him in secret to be like the ultimate leader, and then introduce them later.
Is that a fact?
That's in the books as a fact.
They actually did that?
Yes.
In the show...
Well, that's what everyone's claiming to happen in the book. There's a lot of evidence that this Aegon character is not really... He might be a Targaryen. He might be from the bloodline of like the Blackfyre Targaryens, which are an offshoot of Targaryens that came up when one of the Targaryens lost his mind and legitimized all of his bastard children before he died. Imagine okay. that. You've got a clear successor to the throne. You got this asshole who spent his entire life whoring and being a terrible king, and he's got all these bastards. They're called great bastards because they're also the spawn of him and some other noble-born women, and he legitimizes the lot, which instantly throws the kingdom into civil war because they all have dragons, they all have claims to the throne, and they're all power-mad Targaryens.
Yeah.
But that's like the Blackfyre Rebellion, all these great bastards trying to usurp the throne.
Okay.
And there's some evidence that this Aegon could just be a fraud. He could be a Blackfyre Targaryen, or he could be the actual Aegon. That's something that we haven't determined yet in the books. But what we do know is he claims to be Aegon, and he's the ward of this exiled Lord John Connington. They briefly cross paths with Tyrion and Jorah while they're on route to Meereen, and it's Connington, not Jorah, who contracts the Greyscale. So that whole scene of them going through the Stonemen's River, that all happens, but it's this John Connington character that falls off and gets the Greyscale. Jorah is fine. I have no idea what that remix is all about yet. So book 5 ends with Connington and Aegon having made their way finally back to Westeros and laying siege to Storm's End, the ancestral seat of House Baratheon. A release chapter of book 6 reveals that Doran has received word of the pair's arrival in Westeros and dispatches one of his daughters to assist. With Doran now dead in the show, will the Sand Snakes be the ones to take advantage of this powerful new ally? I could see this coming up towards the end of the season somewhere, since a lot of the groundwork would need to be laid. That said, it seems hard to believe none of this plot will appear, since an extra Targaryen is a pretty major plot device to leave out entirely. Your thoughts? My first thought is, I don't know that Doran is behind this Connington-Aegon/Fagon plot. It could be that once... I haven't read any of the pre-released books or chapters from The Winds of Winter. I'm aware of most of them. But just because I guess he finds out about and dispatches one of his daughters to assist, I don't necessarily mean think that that means he was behind that plot, because again, the way I read it was that that was something that Varys and Illyrio and a couple other Targaryen loyalists, maybe just those two themselves, that's something I considered last season, cooked up this plot. And there's also a lot of the reason why a lot of people suspect he's a fake Targaryen is because one of the many visions that Dany got in the House of the Undying was the fact that there'd be this Mummer's dragon. Mummer is what they call in Westeros, like an acting, you know, like an acting troupe. They don't call them actors; they call them mummers.
Oh, okay.
Like a so
like Monty Python.
Yeah, Mummer's dragon would be, and in I just read over in the off season the Dunk and Egg series.
Yeah.
And there's a couple scenes where there's a Mummer's dragon where it's literally just like a puppet dragon that you'd use in a play, like a fake dragon. So, you know, people, this fake dragon and this Mummer's dragon and Dany being warned about it seems to maybe point that he's not legit.
Okay.
But yeah, whether Dorne's involved or not, I don't know. And I honestly could see them just leaving this entire plot out.
Yeah.
Because unless you think that the Aegon, real or fake, is going to end up sitting on the Iron Throne or being a major player, you could literally excise their entire plot and nothing would change.
Sure.
However, I said that exact same thing about the Greyjoy plot last year.
and here we are.
Did I get to actually finish my thought on the main podcast? Because there's some talk on Reddit to where maybe the Double D's did intend to completely excise that plot, and then when it became clear that George wasn't going to finish the book, it's like, shit. HBO wants us to make more seasons. We kind of want to stall for George to kind of crystallize things more, so you know what? We'll get another two or three episodes out of resurrecting his Greyjoy shit.
That would really suck if then it doesn't become a major thing, right? Like, it feels like if they were going to leave it alone, and George was going to leave it alone, then bringing it back for a few episodes and then just dropping it again would really suck.
Yeah.
This late into the series.
Or it could be that George indicated that it's more central.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, this is such a bizarre situation. It's kind of anyone's guess. But
yeah.
I guess I wouldn't be offended if it leads nowhere and it turns out they did insert this for time, because it's sort of interesting. It is something that Dany needs. She needs ships to get back to Westeros. They already provided her those ships and then burnt them, which is weird, but she does need them. So it's kind of sort of vital.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels like they elegantly remixed them out and now they're putting them back together. But as I mentioned, maybe this is the secret plot to kill Hitler that just didn't come to fruition. And that's kind of cool to throw some of those things in.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, it seems like the Double D's have removed all those to streamline it, because if you want to see all the sprawling action, go read the fucking books. If you want the swashbuckling, pedal to the metal, highlight reel, watch a Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Anyway, so those are my thoughts. And if I got any of that wrong with Doran, I'd be interested to hear about it, because again, I've not read word for word. I sat down once. I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I've read all this stuff. I'm going to sit down and read it. But I started looking to find out where you could actually read them online, and like, there's not a real legit place that's got them all collected.
What are you talking about?
These unreleased, these preview chapters of the Winds of Winter. Because George typically does, like on the con scene, he'll read like a chapter from the book that's not finished to get everybody oohing and on. Uh-huh. Or as it's included in, you know, as an extra material for a compilation he's made, but I didn't find anything that's like short of piracy to read all that stuff. And I'm like, you know what? Fuck this.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck this. I don't want to read a bunch of unconnected chapters. I'll just wait. I mean, I'm fine. People tell me kind of like rough outlines of what happens, but I'll just wait for the damn book to come out. Now,
sure.
That was like 18 months ago, and joke's on me, the book's still not out, but that just explains why that's kind of still a blank spot in my knowledge. Gerard M. says, now that we have a hard out, there's roughly 22 episodes left, I believe, total in the series. Can we start making more accurate predictions on what still needs to happen? So he starts the ball rolling. Here's the main items as I'm seeing it that I'm interested in exploring. 1, Arya needs to complete her training. 2, Daenerys needs to reach Westeros. And 3, we need to figure out how Varys and Littlefinger, arguably the real power brokers on the show and in the books, wind up in the endgame. I'll start with 3.
Nothing about Jon Snow in there, huh?
Well, that's...
Just not interested?
I mean, the big mystery from him just got resolved this episode, so I'll forgive him for
really
not throwing that in.
It just opened up the possibility. Opened up the floodgates of possibility for me.
I guess I'm on full in. Yes, John is definitely going to be a secret Targaryen, and I'll be super surprised if it doesn't turn out now. Like him being resurrected, I'm thinking that's a done deal.
Well, this is a huge problem for Daenerys, right? Like, let's say she does fly her dragons over, and let's say she does try and sit on the throne, kills the Lannisters, takes over King's Landing, and Jon Snow, the real Targaryen heir, comes back. What the fuck?
Well, so I had this debate with an emailer earlier in the week where it's still Dany's got the stronger claim to the throne if you want to grant that you can have a queen sitting upon it, because she's the she's the brother of Rhaegar. Jon, at best, is his son. So she's one generation up from him. She's his aunt. It should be her sitting on the throne. Now, with the Targaryens being freaky deaky with their incest, it could just be that they rule as, you know, incestual king and queen. If you want the, like, super uber, everybody gets their happy ending, everybody ships Jon and Dany.
Right.
You know, sure.
That's creepy.
Yeah. Anyway, but the thing is, no one said the Song of Ice and Fire has to be a happy song. It could be a dirge. So it could be I've talked about this last year. There's ample evidence that Dany's going the way of the Mad King. There's even evidence in the show itself, like, you know, the fact that she had this extreme reaction to the masters of help me out.
Marine.
Thank you. Yeah. For some reason, saying Marine, that doesn't seem right. And the fact that she, like, burnt this guy alive. And in the books, there's a lot of internal dialogue where she's struggling between, like, her darker impulses of fire and blood and the way she thinks that she should rule, which is just and wise as a queen.
Right.
It's entirely possible she ends up being the villain and Jon's the hero that stops her. It's also equally plausible that Jon gets corrupted by dark night magic and she has to be the one. So the Song of Ice and Fire could be a tragedy.
Right.
Anyway, he says about number three, Varys and Littlefinger, I have no fucking clue. So she quickly goes, do you have any ideas? Because, like, to me, I don't.
I don't really. No. I mean, it seems like Littlefinger's just trying to consolidate power in himself, right?
I mean, in the books, and I go in this at length, there's a thing about the whole Fagons thing in the archives. I go in length about the book plot where Varys and Illyrio are secretly plotting to put either a fake or genuine or a Blackfyre Targaryen on the throne for their own purposes. And that you could kind of see this as the ultimate long con. Like, they started working together over in Essos as petty thieves, that Varys was the pickpocket and would steal something valuable from a lord, and Illyrio was the kind of like bounty hunter that would go, and he'd be the guy, if something got stole, he had just fantastic luck in recovering it.
Right, right.
So Varys would take the thing, pawn it, get the money, and then Illyrio would say, I know how to get it back, pay me and I'll get it back. So they get double paid. Yeah. And then Varys realized, you know
what? It's like the Property Brothers.
Sure. Like Pawn Stars.
Yeah.
And then they realized that, like, you know, what's really valuable is these people's secrets. So Varys got really good at stealing secrets and blackmailing people. And there is essentially, this is like their end game is this scheme writ large, that they've essentially stolen the Iron Throne and they're going to mortgage it back.
Okay.
So
that could be cool.
Yeah, it's cool, but it's essentially just kind of like Lex Luthor being a real estate agent. Like, okay, it's cool that you're blowing up California to make a bunch of Nevada sea, but really? This is a real estate scam? Uh-huh. Like, okay, it's cool that you've stolen the Iron, but really? This is just about being richer and more powerful than you already are? I don't know. Littlefinger, who the fuck knows?
Right.
But anyway, going on to number two, which is Daenerys reaching Westeros. Common sense dictates the longer Daenerys takes to reach Westeros, the further south the clash with the Walkers will take place. Notably, the vision in the show that Daenerys had of snow on the Iron Throne would suggest they get as far south as King's Landing. Hmm. Although I will say that there's debate about whether that's snow or ash.
Ooh.
It could be Dragonfire.
Yeah.
Anyway, given this and how many episodes we have left, I'm thinking that Daenerys doesn't make it over to Westeros until at earliest episode 10 of this season and possibly into the next mini season. It now is obvious that the Greyjoy's boats will be necessary, and they haven't even reintroduced them yet. If they have, if I have to sit through another 16 episodes of Daenerys and Essos trying to get to Westeros, I'm afraid at the end of it, that payoff might not be worth the cost. Her storyline is so tired at this point in my mind, especially given how much she has yet to do logically in the plot.
Yeah, like I said before, I think they're trying to fast track that, honestly. Like, they're having a couple of things go on at the same time with getting the boats and also with, you know, her kind of being out of the picture at the moment.
Yeah.
They're searching for her and they're getting the boats at the same time, and those might come to a head right at the end of this season.
And I disagree that it's not interesting seeing what she's been doing. Once you just buckle into the fact that she's not going to Westeros right away, it makes sense that what she's doing in Essos, it is. It's like, you know, queen with training wheels on.
Right.
I also don't know what I think. I feel like that he might be onto something. The episode 10, you know, a lot of seasons, Game of Thrones has the, you know, epic montage of epicness of like the Night's Watch riding forth into the night and Daenerys striding forth naked with her dragons and all these things. I could see her, you know, at the head of a vast fleet of ships with her dragons circling in the air as being like,
shouting, I'm the king of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm the queen of the world.
Where are my dragons? Oh, they're just right there. Never mind. I could see that being like the hammer of that sequence.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like that's what we end on because god damn it, finally. Fucking finally.
And it would certainly get me excited. I mean, dragons and an army coming to King's Landing.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
And I feel like there's enough time for them to wrap that up, introduce the ships, and like there's fucking 8 more episodes, man.
Right.
Like think of like how they've moved in previous seasons. Think of how far we've come in just these 2.
Yeah.
So I'm only going to worry if she doesn't get the... For the first time in many a season, be worried if she doesn't get to Westeros by the end of this season.
Or at least set off toward.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, definitely, like, Meereen is in the rear view mirror and she's heading forward. Because, man, that's going to try a lot of people's patience if we don't get to that far with only 2 half seasons to go.
Yeah.
Says, I have similar feelings for Arya's plotline, which is the number one that he started off with. How much time will you wind up where she's between now and when she's a fully trained faceless person? We've been anticipating her becoming a badass assassin from season 1 or perhaps 2. 5 or even 4 seasons later, she's still not. Then presumably she needs to make her way over to Westeros to do what exactly? I hope by the time she's done, there's more than one mission she's charged with, or maybe there'll be a spinoff. At least with Arya, I'm sure the journey, or rather the murder she commits along the journey, will be as much fun as the endpoint.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about Arya. I don't even know if she's going to become a faceless person.
I don't think she'll officially be... I mean, I think she'll become... it'd be like a Batman situation.
Right.
Like, he's trained in the League of Shadows, he gets the ultimate test, and he's like, fuck all this, I'm going to be Batman.
Yeah, I'm just going to take my skills and leave.
I think Arya will be like, thanks for the training, jackasses.
Yeah.
I'm going to go my own path. But... what does she do? Because if Dany's got her dragons and Jon's got his freaky ice powers, what do you need her assassin powers for?
Well, I mean, is this just literally like a personal journey for Arya, for revenge? I mean,
that
maybe
is,
it is. It's not as, you know, epic as a fucking dragon fight and a war with Winter in the North. Like, not as epic, but still valuable to Arya.
But... yes, and I'm sympathetic to that because I like Arya's character a bunch, but if it has literally nothing to do with the culmination of the plot, then that feels like a lot of jerking around for nothing. Like, I am reading it for the story of this little girl's transformation personal journey, but I'm also not.
Right, that, right.
The journey is not the fucking destination in this case.
Okay.
And as more and more people on her list get killed or be written off as irrelevant in the show, it's like, man, what is she going to be left to do?
Yeah. What if a couple of those players, one or a few of those players, the people on our list, become important to, more important to the central plot?
Could be.
And then she's got to go in and kill them, or maybe they even become like allies of someone, and she has to go in, and she's still on her personal journey. She's got to kill them. That fucks up plans elsewhere. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
there are ways to weave it back into the main plot.
I guess I've never really thought until now where exactly is her plot going that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I will say that they really made it a big plot point that her and Jon Snow were very, very close.
Right.
They hammer in the books that they are the ones that really favor Lyanna. there's a personal affinity because they both kind of feel like outsiders in the Starks, because Arya doesn't want to be a Stark woman.
Yeah.
Which also ties her back to Lyanna, because Lyanna was all about, I'm the best horse rider here. And there's even an extended sequence in the books that implies that she like pretended to be a knight at one point and was quite successful at it. So there's a lot of things that tie her and Jon together. It would be interesting to have them be in opposition somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if, you know, Arya feels like she has to murder Dany for some reason and Jon has to stop her? Or what if Arya is assigned to kill Jon Snow by the Faceless Men?
Oh, sure, by the Faceless Men.
That would be something to do. Like, I don't know. Like, but I feel like that there's it's something important about her and the fact that she buried Needle and the fact that that was the parting gift that Jon gave her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's their fates are going to be intertwined, and that's what's going to be – that's the end game that's satisfying. That they get thrown back together and probably as adversaries. I don't know. It doesn't feel like allies, because that doesn't feel like what this book is series is all about. But I'd be curious to see what anyone else thinks about that. Moving on, Jake C. Hey, guys, after listening after episode one, I started thinking a lot about the White Walkers and how they come into play. We know the Night's King is their leader, and he used to be the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. It's said that he proclaimed himself king and rules the Night Fort. We also know the Night Fort is where both Bran and Sam and Gilly used to move past the wall. Maybe the Night's King leads his army through the Night Fort, the secret entrance through the Night Fort. I don't know, because there's a lot of hints in the books that there's some kind of magic ability to the wall that precludes the others and the whites and the White Walkers from being able to pass through it.
Right.
In fact, there's some evidence that perhaps the wall gets torn down before everything's said and done.
Mm-hmm.
There's this story about this Joramund's horn that you can blow, and it's supposed to be able to destroy the wall. Like, that's another thing that might blow your mind. Like, be prepared for that wall to fall this season.
Yeah.
And what the fuck that will mean. So, I like your theory, because there is, like, why introduce this way to get to and from the wall if you're not going to use it later, but I don't know that the Night's King's going to need it. And also, that Night's King stuff still is not confirmed. It's more, like, legend and theory than fact, but pretty good textual evidence for it. And, by the way, again, in the archives, I go in a deep dive about the Night's King and the others and their relationship to the wall, so check that out if you're interested. Nicole K., says, my boyfriend asked me tonight if there's any fathers left on the show, by which he meant an older generation male head of a major house. The only ones I could think of in the show that was introduced was Mace Tyrell. I did tell him about the Umbers and the Manderleys mainly because they were mentioned in the past episode, and they might come into play in the near future. I didn't mention Papa Tarly, which is Sam's father, because I figured that if we were going to see him, Sam will meet him soon on the show. Am I forgetting anyone? I mean, Ned, Tywin, Oberyn, Jor, Balin, Roose, they're all now dead. Is there any man left of an older generation? Though, I mean, in the books, there's plenty. There's Jon Royce in the Vale, and there's a couple other minor lords. You know, as you mentioned, the Manderleys and the Umbers, Great John's still alive, the Wyman Manderley's still alive. The Blackfish, which is Catelyn's uncle. The guy who took over from her brother to set her father on fire, he's still out and about doing his thing. But you're right. This seems to be a story of the new generation having to take control from the old before their time. And also, maybe the new generation is comprised of more women and less, you know, old men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that could be an interesting plot point, too. Any thought? You probably don't. That's pretty much a bookish question.
Sounds about right, yeah.
All right, David V. says, irony seems to play such a huge role in the series. Putting the Targaryens aside as rightful rulers to the throne for a second, does it not seem completely ironic that Cersei is, by all rights, the rightful queen of Westeros? I'm reading this email to make a point, just by the way. With Stannis, Shireen, and Renly pushing up daisies, and Gendry not in the mix at the moment, there are no Baratheons to take the throne. Mm-hmm. However, if you go back 150 years before Robert was even born, Corran Baratheon had 6 children with a woman named Lyanne. One of them was Arion, which was Robert's great-great-great-grandfather. The next one down to have surviving children was Eliana. She married a lord named Mathlin. Mathlin Lannister. Mathlin fathered Jason, who fathered Daemon, who fathered Gerald, who fathered Tytus Lannister.
Oh, God.
Who was Tytus' firstborn son?
Jor-El. I don't know.
No, it was Tywin. Boom goes the dynamite. Is there any reason that this is not brought up? Why is there such a lack of knowledge of the family history? I'm going to leave that question hanging in the room because
okay,
I consider myself and everyone listening to this podcast in the top 1%
right.
of Game of Thrones knowledge. And like, let's say I was the bottom of the top 1% of basketball players in the world.
Yeah,
I could still play LeBron and he'd beat my ass because the gap between it's the bell curve, right? It just gets steeper and steeper at the edges.
Mm-hmm.
You, David, are like the top 1% of the 1% because I don't know any of that fucking shit.
I certainly don't.
And yes, you can get this is all in like the worlds of ice and fire and you can look all this lineage up, but there's no way George expects us all to know that. So the reason why this knowledge isn't more commonly known is because, number one, no one's got the lineage for all these houses memorized except for maybe George himself mm-hmm. and a few of his personal acolytes that help him out on things. And there's probably a couple Uber fans that just like there's people that can recite pi out to 1,000 decimal places.
Yeah.
If it's going to be plot important, they have to surface that knowledge in a way that's much more easily to be digested.
Yeah. And I mean, frankly, you just laid it all out there.
Yeah.
That would just bore the shit out of me
yeah.
as a viewer and completely not stick.
And can you imagine Cersei getting up and saying, I'm actually the rightful queen because yada, 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 yada. People would be like, boo, yeah. get off the stage. You
it's
know?
Eye roll time. Like from the viewers and the people she's speaking to. Like,
the reason she's got the rightful rule is because she's got a 7-foot tall undead monster
right.
at her side.
Right.
That's the important thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not denigrating the book knowledge here.
Sure,
I'm just saying
sure.
that like you got to realize that if that's, you know, if that's something that needs to be worried about or planned for, it's got to be surfaced another way because nobody knows that.
Yeah.
Like if there's 20 people in this world that know that complete heraldry, I'd be amazed. All that genealogy.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. Let's move on. This is I guess there's a couple more. There's about three more. Corey P. wants to know, why do you think Brienne didn't tell Sansa that Arya was with the Hound? She just said she was with a man. Now, I'm mentioning this in a spoiler podcast because I wanted to say, and I didn't have time to research it, I wanted to say that I don't think that Brienne knows that the Hound is the Hound.
Really?
I mean, she comes back to King's Landing for maybe the first time at Joffrey's wedding. That happens after the Battle of Blackwater,
right.
which is where the Hound fucks off.
Yeah.
He's not wearing his... I get it. He's a big dude, but he's not like the biggest dude in the kingdom. That's his brother. He's not wearing his signature Hound helmet. How the hell would she know that that is the Hound?
Interesting.
And
yeah.
It could be that he says, I'm the Hound, bitch, before... I mean, I don't remember. I saw their fight, but I didn't know if there's another time that they might have met. So I didn't want to stick it out there and like maybe spoil someone or whatnot. But in my mind, the Brienne doesn't know that the Hound is the Hound.
Okay.
Also, we know it's not the first time that she withheld information from Sansa, because that's one thing that people had a problem with last year when she met Sansa, is she didn't lead off with, hey, I saw your sister. She's alive.
Right.
So, yeah. I could go either
way. Maybe she's
way.
Saving something for the road trip.
And I'm gonna read this on this next week's Tuesday podcast. And if anybody's got information to dispute this, please let me know because I'd like to have more complete information. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to farm some brain cycles out. But yeah, I just don't know that she knows that the Hound is the Hound. Although, again, he's a tall dude with prominent facial scars.
Sure.
You would think that she would have. He's one of the more famous fighters in Westeros from a the mountains, arguably the most, he's right up there with Jaime Lannister and Barristan Bold as the most prominent fighter in Westeros. So it's not unreasonable that she would have heard from him, but I don't know. Next week, some theories about the Oathbreaker episode. Chad M says, regarding Oathbreaker, if Jon is resurrected and leaves the Night's Watch, isn't he breaking his oath, i.e. the title of the episode?
Not technically. We've discussed this before.
Technically correct. The best type of correct there is.
He's going to rules lawyer him and then fuck off south.
But just like we said, like your claim to the throne is only as strong as that you can back it up. Like his claim to be not an Oathbreaker is only as strong as the argument that he can make.
He made a pretty good argument. Just lift his shirt.
Well, right.
Like, come on.
I was dead. Y'all knew I was dead.
Right.
You fuckers stabbed me to death.
Skin. Yep.
You actually killed me.
Yeah.
So, yeah. There is an implication, too, that, like, someone also wrote in a kind of similar thought. And it's like, well, even if he says, I'm not an Oathbreaker, he goes south to do whatever. We know that anytime you escape from the Night's Watch, they execute you because, you know, you deserted the Night's Watch. John comes and says, no, I didn't desert. I was killed and then magically resurrected by a Red Witch.
Yeah. Again, lift your shirt. Show them the wounds.
Yeah, people got scars.
Is his skin going to go back to normal tone?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, if he looks like he's fucking dead and he's walking around and maybe going, like, who knows what he's going to be like?
There could be a debate about whether John's an Oathbreaker or not. I wouldn't be surprised. But it seems from the previews that there are terms like a god being thrown around regarding him.
Okay.
People think you're a god. I don't think you stand in the way of God when he wants to leave the wall.
Yeah.
I am interested in, and the other thing is, we mentioned this in the main cast, right? That, like, even if John is freed from his duties, he might not just abandon him right away because he's the best man for the job right now.
Right. And he knows what's up.
I could see him promoting Davos to Lord Commander.
Okay.
And I think Davos is, you know, his big arc about his son dying. Like, I feel like he's kind of ready to dedicate his life to the realm, and he never really wanted to hold lands or titles anyway.
Uh-huh.
He'd be a natural fit. Lord Commander Ed, Dolorous Ed would be a nice touch. I could see John even being like, you know what, Alistair Thorne, you're the best one for the job. And now you see that I've come back, and you're not going to be an asshole to the wildlings. So, like, if you promise not to fuck with these arrangements, I'll make you the Lord Commander because you're the best candidate.
Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know about that one.
Oof, indeed. I don't know. Dennis B. from Brooklyn wants to give an opinion on the upcoming episode entitled Oathbreaker. Since it's looking like it'll be a flashback episode of Tower of Joy, I think the title could be alluding to Jaime for breaking his oath as a Kingsguard and killing the Mad King. It's one of the many major events leading up to the Tower of Joy. What do you guys think? What does it tell us, though? We already know this.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, I mean, I guess it could be about Jaime because he is, in fact, an Oathbreaker.
Right.
And it's also symmetry from when he handed Brienne the blade on the episode called Oathkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't give us any new information. So, my money's on something with John, something with Ned breaking his promise to Lyanna, and that being plot specific or plot centric. Those are my best guesses, but, you know, they're just guesses. So,
okay.
That's all that we got this week. Is there anything you wanted to add before we move on?
Nope, I'm good.
All right, as always, please send emails to gameofthrones@baldmove.com or go on to forums.baldmove.com. It does seem like there's going to be a weekly correction thread to my spoiler edition, which I fully endorse and support. So if I've made some mistakes or you want to chime in about this Hodor business or especially about the Hound and whether Brienne might know the Hound or whether she lied to Sansa or why that would be, that'd be a good place to put it. But yeah, you know, this stuff is kind of driven by you guys at this point. I can't wait. The Tower of Joy is going to be fucking rad.
Yeah, it should be cool.
From the previews, not only are we getting it, but it actually seems like they're going to get into the battle, which has always been like, you've got some of the best swordsmen. Like Sir Arthur Dane, who kind of wields his own special sword called Dawn, which I almost talked about this week, but I'm going to see how prominent it is next week. You got some of the best Kingsguard fighters of all time with Ned and this Howland Reed and a bunch of other Northerners, and you know, it's a 7-on-3 battle royale, and only two guys walk away from it. There hasn't been a lot of really epic sword fights.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Cyril Farrell taking down the Kingsguard with a wooden sword. Ned and Jaime that kind of got interrupted. You know, Ned and Brienne. Brienne and the Hound. Oberyn and, you know.
Right, in the mountain, sure.
I guess there's more than I've given it credit
for.
There
have been a few, but, you know, over the last season, I mean,
Hardhome,
you know, Hardhome was, like, pretty badass.
Sure, sure.
Not a single epic fight, but.
Yeah, I mean, but there's, like, cool things like Ned's sword shattering. The White Walker and whatnot. But this could be, like, you know, a real title card type of thing. So
yeah.
I'm excited. And we'll see what happens with this episode, Oathbreaker. We'll see you again right after the episode airs on Sunday night. We'll have the instant takeout as quick as we can. Of course, if you're a club member, you can actually watch us record live. It's the quickest way to get it. And we'll see you then on the next Tuesday.
Yep, see ya.
Bye.